So we covered like the first 45, 46 verses in the last class. And the first 8 verses talked about sort of the setting. What's this all about? And it's about the fact that bodhisattvas thrive on mental afflictions. Their sustenance is dealing with mental afflictions. They don't seek them out, but when they appear, then a bodhisattva uses them to transform them into good things, into positive energy. And thereby destroys them in the process. It's sort of like the Tonglen practice. When you take that black smoke into your heart, there's a nuclear explosion in there and everything's gone, including the mental affliction that you brought into your heart from yourself at that time. And then there's a whole series of verses that talk about karmic correlations. Like, when this happens to you, it's because, and then it gives the reason. And in the last, 10 or so of those first 45 verses, we're beginning to understand that the enemy, the thing that's causing this, is our own self-cherishing. And the karmic correlations have more to do with taking care of yourself than taking care of other people. And when particular bad things happen to you, we should take a look at that. Is this due to self-cherishing? And if it is, then that's a good sign to us, you know, that we have to do something else. Either stop doing what we're doing or do the opposite, or, as we're going to see today, there are things that we do that don't seem to have any relation to the problem that we're experiencing. There are things that we should do to stop the problems that we're experiencing that don't seem to have any relation to the problems themselves. So the Wheel of Knives is like this kind of boomerang, you know, that gets thrown out. Every time you do a bad deed, you throw out this boomerang that has, it's a wheel, it's spinning, and it circles around and eventually comes back and slices you. And so every time any bad thing happens to you, it's this Wheel of Knives that's come back that we've thrown out earlier. And we need to understand that. So basically, this all boils down to, stopping our ignorance. It's more than stopping ignorance. Ignorance, I guess we could say, is the understanding we have that things come from their own side. They have a nature of their own, and that's not true. And in that case, ignorance is simply knowing the wrong thing. It's not being ignorant of what's going on. It's that we have the absolutely wrong idea about the way things exist. And it's that wrong idea, this grasping to a nature of a self nature of things that's causing our problems. So at this point in the text, the author, Dharma Rakshita, but it's ourselves, we get mad. Really, really mad. And we start to go after the real enemy. This is the enemy who's been making us commit all these bad deeds, it's the enemy that causes us to throw out that wheel continually, several times an hour, maybe even a dozen times an hour, and it comes back and slices it up. And we don't understand the wheel. But now, around verse 50, we're beginning to understand that there is an enemy who is in fact us, and it's our misunderstanding of things that's causing us our suffering in the long run. So now, Dharma Rakshita, or us, we transform ourselves into a wrathful deity, Yamantaka. And Yamantaka is, you know, he's a badass guy. He's got dozens of arms and a little over a dozen legs. And he's got, I don't know, 9 heads, something like that, that are shaped like bulls. And, you know, there are horns coming up from there. And there's lightning coming out of the horns and lightning flashing between the horns and stuff like that. And one of the weapons that he holds in his arms is the Wheel of Knives. So, you know, this section, let me find it here and I'll read it to you. Well, it starts actually in at the beginning of reading 9. You know, since this is the way things are, I finally realized just who my enemy is. I've caught the thief who lay in wait and deceived me with his trap. He's a master raider fooling others and fooling himself as well. I see it now. He's the habit I have of grasping to myself, and of this there can be no doubt. Now, let's see the Wheel of Knives of Karma cut his skull. O angel of wrath, now cut his skull, cut thrice, stand like a god on widespread legs, and knowledge of two truths, stare in hatred with the eyes of method and wisdom. Open your jaws and show your fangs, 4 powers of confession. Sink them deep within the flesh of this, my hated foe. So, this is a really strong verse, you know. It isn't like, please go away, mental afflictions. I mean, you've called upon Yamantaka. You've transformed yourself into Yamantaka. And Yamantaka is going to get rid of those things for you. You as Yamantaka are going to do it. So we're understanding that we have 2 states of mind that are our true enemy. One is self-cherishing. Rong Chenzen is the Tibetan. And this is where we're watching out for ourselves. We're taking care of number one, us, you know, as opposed to taking care of other people. We will do what benefits us before we begin to think about others. And since we're always kind of suffering, we're always taking care of ourselves. We're watching out for number one. It's the self-cherishing. And the other state of mind is this grasping to a self. And this is the state of mind that thinks that self really exists. You know, this state of mind doesn't understand that there is no self from its own side. There is nothing that makes you up from its own side. Whatever idea you have about yourself is coming from causes and conditions. It's from karma and nothing else. There isn't any part of you that exists from its own side. Do you exist? Yes. Do you exist from your own side? No. So if we can get to the point where we conquer these 2 enemies, these 2 states of mind, then our suffering can go away and we can reach our goals. We can become Buddhas. You know, another way to look at this is that the problems that we have come from us, you know. The proof of that is that other people seeing us suffering can interpret the reasons in a different way from us, you know. And the example I like to give a lot, you know, is that your boss yells at you and you feel terrible about that. It's a yelling boss and he's really mean. But the guy in the cubicle next to you thinks it's about time you got yelled at because you're such a jerk. The same event is being interpreted in two different ways. So there is nothing about the boss that comes from the boss's side. It's simply the way we interpret it when we yelled at, and the person next to us interprets it as an avenging angel, something like that. Now, this avenging angel is the one that we're calling on, Yamantaka, to take care of the problems that we have of these two states of mind. Now, this Tibetan term, dakshin, grasping to a self, the word Zen has just kind of an idea of holding something, like you might be holding your pen right now. It's also used in the what kind of abstract sense of holding a thought in your mind. But it also can be used to grasp at something, you know, like somebody drops something and you're right nearby and you reach out and grab it to keep it from falling on the floor, that kind of grasping, a very strong thing. So Zen has both of these words. And typically, you know, when we first start talking about grasping to things as being self-existent, it is this kind of very strong, almost desperate sense. You know, that we're grasping at things that are going to give us pleasure, for example, or on the opposite thing, shoving them away, you know, very forcefully, because they're going to bring us unhappiness. But after we've been practicing it for a while, that kind of desperation fades away because we have an intellectual understanding of, yeah, things don't exist from their own side. I got that, you know. Except in the moment, they seem to. You know, especially in moments of great pleasure or great unhappiness, that we revert back to, yeah, things do come from their own side. But it's not this kind of desperate thing. So this idea of grasping, where we're just kind of holding on to the fact that, yeah, things do come from their own side, is very subtle. And the only time it occurs is when things are sort of intense for us. And at that point, we are so involved in what's going on that we don't have the intellectual capacity to think, oh, that's not really coming from its own side. And it's these kind of things that we have to begin to attack. So the verse, the second verse that I just read, he's describing what Yamantaka, particular aspects of Yamantaka. And the first one is, no, maybe it's the first verse. Oh, yeah, stand like a god on widespread legs. There are two legs there. Now, there is a form of Yamantaka that is two legs, two arms, one head. And the two legs represent method and wisdom. That's not true. Oh, he's going to destroy these things we just talked about, the self-cherishing and the grasping to self-existence. And so those are the two legs of the angel of death. Now, the angel of death isn't Yama, who's sort of like the, you know, the guy that comes and in sort of Christian lore, you know, when it's time to die with this big, what, scythe, I guess they call it, or sickle or something, who's going to take you, you know, who's going to kill you. It's not that kind of, Yamantaka is not that one. Yamantaka is the Lord over Yama. Yamantaka, the Lord over Yama. But we can look at this angel of death as the angel who's holding the wheel of life. You've seen pictures of that. And he's got two legs. And those represent the grasping at self-existence and the self-cherishing state of mind. And then it talks about the two truths. And the two truths are two ways of looking at reality. There's kind of a conventional way. It's called Kunzop. It's reality for a deceived state of mind or a deceiving state of mind. And then there's the ultimate reality, which is the way things really exist. And these two realities surround us. The Abhisamya Alamkara says that we must always operate within these two truths. Until we become Buddhas, they are there. And we are not, we cannot deny either one, but we have to recognize them and begin to distinguish which is which. You know, so the deceptive reality is us as unenlightened beings, and it's the world around us that we perceive, that we experience. We experience the world as existing from its own side. And once we've gotten to the point where maybe we don't hold that so far, there still is a world that comes from causes and conditions that are the result of the way we have treated others in the past. And what we're experiencing comes about through conceptual thought, like we apply names to things. So you're sitting in your room right now listening to this, and you're applying to labels to everything that you perceive. Every word that I speak triggers a conceptual process in your mind. And you're looking at your computer screen, maybe, or a picture on the wall, or you're holding your pen, things like that. Everything around you is constructed through a conceptual process that is thrown upon basically neutral objects. It is true that those neutral objects also come from projections of your mind. But it's top level. That's what we call deceptive reality, conventional reality, and it comes from causes and conditions. All of our mental afflictions are deceptive reality. Our great pleasures themselves are deceptive reality. And so that's one way of looking at the world. And then the other way is ultimate reality. And ultimate reality basically is the fact that none of these things that we think exist independent of our projections of them. Yes, things are out there, but the ultimate nature of them is that they are there in dependence upon our projection of them. They are not there by themselves. So this idea of the two truths is sort of two sides of the same coin. It's different ways of understanding our reality. So the way we go through this process is that first we understand the ultimate reality, you know, this world that we've never seen before. We understand it at an intellectual level. You've meditated on it. You've thought about it a lot. If somebody asked you why things don't exist from their own side, you could probably give them a pretty good explanation of it. It doesn't mean they would accept it, but you have an idea of why this is true. You've thought it out. So we start with that. We start with this intellectual understanding. And that's what's happening here. You know, we're asking Yamantaka, you know, to turn the wheel of knives on this enemy, which is the two-sided thing, our self-cherishing and our grasping at ourselves. And that's a conceptual thing. We're working at that, but we're working at it from an intellectual point of view. So we can begin to get a deep understanding of the true nature of reality conceptually, intellectually. And then later on, once we've got that, then we can have a direct perception of emptiness, of the true nature of things. So we're asking Yamantaka to bring his death, you know, his ability to get rid of things, you know, to the heart of the butcher, who is the self-cherishing mind and the mind that grasps things as self-existent. And then we have the phrase two eyes. The two eyes are method and wisdom. And method is the first four and a half, I guess, of the Bodhisattva perfections, you know, the six perfections. Giving, leading an ethical way of life, patience, or learning to overcome anger, and then taking great joy in doing good things. And then these first four and a half perfections create positive energies. And those particular energies that come from those four and a half perfections provide us with our Buddha body. Now, they will ripen as the body of a Buddha when we become a Buddha. And then wisdom really is understanding the two truths. You know, and it comes from perfectly practicing contemplation and wisdom. Wisdom that comes from contemplation, from meditation. So the angel of death has these two eyes, you know, that really see things as they are. And it is doing this by practicing the six perfections all together that lead us eventually to enlightenment. That's what this is about. And what are we doing? We're zeroing in on the self-grasping and self-cherishing to get rid of those things. And we can lump those into ignorance, I guess, call them ignorance. We're going to destroy it. And we're calling upon our practice to this point that has enabled us to transform ourselves into Yamantaka. So Yamantaka, in some way, is our understanding of the way things really work, you know, and the fact that, yes, these two enemies we have, they are me, and they come from me. And because they come from me, I can do something about it and get rid of them. And then there's four fangs of the angel of death. And these are the four forces. And we've gone over these in the karma class. It's what you do when you do your book. One of the ways that we begin to lessen the hold of karma on what we do, at least on the bad things that we do, is to use the four forces to purify old bad karma so that it reaches the point where it may not ripen. We can't get rid of it, but we can weaken it so it doesn't get ripen, so it really doesn't ripen for us. Or we can cause it to ripen early as something much less severe than it would have been normally, like a rebirth in the hell realms, for example. So we're using this tantric monster, Yamantaka, to get rid of our bad karma. So Yamantaka is doing a whole bunch of things for us. He's showing us really the true nature of the bad things that happen to us and the reason we treat others poorly. He's showing us the enemy very, very clearly. And he is showing us how to develop the wisdom and the methods that are going to lead us to enlightenment. And he's showing us how to purify the old bad karma. And that's really, you know, that's not bad. So when we call on Yamantaka, Yamantaka comes, we turn into him, you know, and we basically are stomping our feet on the ground as we're doing this. And you can just imagine it. I mean, this is wrathful. The things underneath Yamantaka's feet are our mental afflictions, and he's stomping on those. He's going to get rid of them, smashing them. So that's really kind of neat, you know. And is Yamantaka then, this angel over the Lord of Death, is he a metaphor? Are these qualities we've been talking about a metaphor? You know, and the answer is no. It's not a metaphor. The being does exist. And that being is created by us as we do our practice, as we fill our toolbox full of ways of dealing with our mental afflictions, as we begin to understand that others are more important than we are, and taking care of them is the way that we generate the good karma to get enlightened and to get rid of our mental afflictions. Those practices are what create Yamantaka for us. So Yamantaka is just as real as the person we are right now. And we'll reach a point where we can develop ourselves into Yamantaka. And Yamantaka will be the first empowerment that you get when you finish the ACI courses. So, it's important here to realize that, you know, we've talked about Yamantaka, but any of the tantric deities are created by our karma. Do they exist? They do indeed. They are just as real as we are. They do not manifest for us right now, at least in obvious ways, because we don't yet have the karma for that to happen. But you're probably experiencing the results of your practice as really kind of unusual things happening to you, both good and bad. But unusual good things, you know, that just haven't happened before, or they may be realizations you're getting. Things like that, you know. So the reality around us really can change, you know. It's not just your imagination. You know, when you're doing Tonglen, we're imagining that we're taking on these things, but we get really good at it, and it seems to become real for us. And just like that, we can imagine a Buddha paradise. We can imagine these tantric deities. And then after a while, we stop imagining them. They take on a life, you know, just like the friends or enemies around you. And that happens because of the way that you practice, you know. And basically what that means is you practice carefully and you keep your vows. Then there's a section in here where Dharmarakshita talks about the wheel of karma. Now, in one sense, the wheel of knives is a wheel of karma because, you know, as we do something bad, we hurl this wheel out and it spins around out there and eventually comes back and and gets us. But the wheel of karma is the understanding that anything that we do comes back to us. So the wheel of knives is basically about the bad things that we do. You know, it comes back and hurts us. But the good things that we do, it's like tossing out a wheel of I don't know, nice soft feathers or something. And eventually it comes back and just sort of caresses our skin and makes us happy. Something like that, maybe. But the idea is that none of this is self-existent, right? It's all the result of our karma. So our self-cherishing and the grasping to things as self-existent is just a projection of our mind, like everything else. It doesn't exist from its own side. And the wheel of karma then can be used to eliminate that. So self-cherishing specifically can be eliminated by doing Tonglen. And this is a breathing practice where you take away the pain of other people and give them your pleasure, give them your happiness. And that will eliminate your selfishness. So if you get really good at that, you will begin to see other people as needing your help, and you will have this attitude, I have to help them. I will do this. I can do this. And then ignorance, you know, the ignorance that sees things as self-existent is eliminated with wisdom. Now, you know, basically all these ACI courses talk about developing wisdom. We look at different things we have to understand in order to see things correctly. And the course that did this most for us was the Diamond Cutter. And we haven't had it yet, but course 12, which is the last part of the Guide of the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, is on the wisdom chapter of that text by Master Shantideva. And it goes through wisdom in some detail itself. So we talked about the two collections of merit and wisdom. And those come about through practicing the six perfections, as I said. Now, we have to understand that as we practice, that these collections of merit and wisdom are going to grow. They can be destroyed by moments of anger. But if we've dedicated the good things that we do, that kind of guards them from being destroyed. So it's important to dedicate. So these collections grow and grow in us. And eventually, they will turn us into Buddhas. The collection of merit is going to give us the two form bodies of a Buddha, and the collection of wisdom is going to give us the Dharmakaya, the mind of a Buddha, and the emptiness of the mind of a Buddha. And as we do these practices, what happens is that our inner body, our inner spiritual body, begins to change. And as that happens, the channels become less constricted, the winds flow more easily. And as we said before, you know, our mind rides on winds. It rides on energies in the central channel. And if we can get things going correctly there, then our minds improve. As our minds improve, the channels and the winds improve. It's kind of a nice kind of, once it gets started, it can't be stopped. And that's a great thing to have. So when our channels open up completely, we become a Buddha. So Dhammarakshita says, you know, that before we reach enlightenment, during that time, we love and cherish each other. Sort of like the fact that everybody is ourselves, you know. It's sort of doing this, you know, we love and cherish each other as one. We aren't the same. You know, we are separate mind streams, and they don't overlap. You know, the things that I do will produce results for me, but not for you. And the things that you do produce results for you, but not for me. We have to understand that. But we begin to look at everybody else as sort of being like us, really, you know. And this is called equanimity. We don't hold, we don't like some people more than other people. We don't dislike some people more than other people. We think of everybody, we view them as the same as us. You know, somebody asked Jesus what the greatest commandment was, and he said to love the Lord God, thy God with all your strength, all your heart, all your spirit, and all your mind, right? Which is from Deuteronomy. And then he said, and the second one, he wasn't asked about a second one. He said the second one's the same. You know, love your neighbor as yourself. This is what's going on here, that you begin to get rid of distinctions between me and you. They aren't any different. So then you get to the point where you will do anything to help anybody else. You will go anywhere to help anybody else. You can go to the hell realms, like Avalokiteshvara did, and help the beings there. You can go to the hungry ghost realm and help the beings there. You can go to the animal realm and help the beings there, and so on. Into the worldly being realm and the desire realm, or the form and formless realms. You can go anywhere, and you would do that. You'll be happy wherever you are. If you have to move from where you are right now, that would be fine with you as a bodhisattva. You're perfectly willing to go where everybody else needs to be. This is before you become enlightened. You know, when you become enlightened, then you automatically go to wherever anybody needs you. So the transformation, you know, the transformations happen because we're generating the karma for them to happen. And as we're doing our Tonglen practice, we are transforming other people's pain into happiness. In the meditation, we're taking their pain from them into ourselves, destroying our own self-cherishing at the same time, and then giving back our happiness to them. The kind of explosion that takes place in our hearts gets rid of that suffering, and our understanding of that creates happiness in us, and then we send that happiness back out to everybody else. So really what we're doing is we're transforming their pain into happiness for them. And we're able to do that. The more and more we practice Tonglen, the better we become at doing that. And then when the boss yells at us, we think, I wonder what happened to him this morning. Did his wife yell at him or something like that? You know, what can I do? Can I help in any way? That's the kind of thing. So, you know, the bodhisattvas, the peacocks, you know, in the jungle of poisonous plants, you know, take on any negative thing and transform it into something positive. Mainly, we start off doing that for ourselves, but then we do it for others as well. We thrive on that. You know, in the movie The Little Buddha, when Buddha's sitting down to become enlightened, Mara's armies, you know, come and they shoot flaming arrows at him. And then we see Buddha under the tree, and what's coming down are rose petals, flower petals. It's really beautiful. And it's nice to think that he's transforming the arrows into petals. And that's okay to think that way. But really, what's going on is the arrows have no nature of their own. Mara's armies see them as flaming arrows. Lord Buddha sees the same objects as rose petals. So there's not any transformation going on, really. It's just that the karmic projections that Lord Buddha is having are the result of the fact that he is just about to become a Buddha. And everything in his environment is pleasant for him. It's not harmful. So, if Lord Buddha didn't have that karma as he's sitting there, then the arrows would have come to him. How do we understand that? The bad things that happen to me are due to my karma. What's coming at me is neutral. What I'm experiencing is due to my karma. And now we're asking Yamantaka to destroy that karma for us, to destroy those tendencies to see things as harmful to us. And the way that we do that is begin to transform things. So keep your vows. Understand that when you're being hurt, it's just the result of your karma. And try to turn that into something positive. At least, you know, see it as for what it is. Just the way you've treated others in the past. But maybe after some practice, you'll begin to turn it into something positive as well. Now, Dharma Rakshita gives several explanations, several kind of metaphors for what emptiness is. And one of them is the face in a mirror. Now, as you look at a mirror, you're looking at yourself, and you're seeing the face. But that face, the one you're looking at, is not a real person. Another example he gives is somebody, this is at night, somebody has a torch, and they're swinging it in a circle. And what we see, if they're doing it fast enough, is simply a circle of light. You know, in fact, the torch isn't a circle of light. You know, as it's moving around, it's just one point of light going around in a circle. But we can see it as a circle of light. Now, neither of those things, neither of those appearances is what the thing is. The face we see in a mirror looks to us to be real. Yeah, I would say, well, that's me. But are we really saying that's a non-existent me? We're just saying that's me. And the circle of fire is another one. Another example he uses is fog. You know, there's no substance to fog. It keeps us from seeing things beyond it. But it's not solid. There's nothing there, right? This, you know, he uses the phrase, things are an illusion, you know. And that's what these examples point out. The face in the mirror is an illusion. It's not real. The solid circle of light is not real. It's an illusion. And the fog bank looking solid is an illusion, too, because it's not. So we have to be careful about that. We have to understand that everything comes from something else. And because of that, we understand that nothing exists by itself alone. And when you become teachers, you have to teach this to your students very, very carefully, over and over. you know, like I do, like Eshla does, like the other Diamond Mountain teachers do. Emptiness always implies dependent origination, meaning that everything's coming from the projections of our own mind. Do things exist? Yes. How do they exist? Independence upon other things. And if that's the case, then they are not themselves the cause of their own existence. They have no nature of their own. So now Master Dharma Rakshita says that your enemy of misunderstanding things, it doesn't exist at all. It does exist, but his statement means that it doesn't exist from its own side. He says it doesn't exist at all. What he means is that it doesn't exist from its own side. Whenever you see in text that something doesn't exist at all, especially, from writers in the Prasangika school, doesn't exist at all means that it doesn't exist from its own side, unless something isn't there, like the horns of a rabbit. The horns of a rabbit don't exist at all. There's not even any base because there's nothing there. Now, our ignorance is to misunderstanding the emptiness of all things. And that ignorance, the emptiness itself, has its own emptiness, and that's why you can eliminate your ignorance. It's very good. There's a reference to filling a pitcher drop by drop. If you took a water pitcher and you had a big bowl of water that would fill that pitcher, but you took a medicine dropper and you began to fill the pitcher just one drop at a time, the pitcher itself isn't filled by any one of those drops. The first drop doesn't fill it, and the last one doesn't do it either, or the last 10 doesn't do it either. And we have to look deeply into what this means. In Fundamental Wisdom by Master Nagarjuna, he says that things are not their parts alone. Things are not their parts altogether. Things are not both their parts alone and altogether, and things aren't not their parts and not their parts alone and not their parts altogether. Now we tend to think, that things are their parts altogether. I mean, you look at your pen, and you can think about the parts of the pen, and you put all those parts together, and you've got a pen, right? So we tend to think, even if we understand that the pen doesn't come from its own side, but it's there independent upon its parts, the idea is that the sum of the parts doesn't make the thing. It's only the sum of the parts put together on which we base a projection of pen that makes the pen. Our perception has to be added to the equation of everything. If you just lay the pen down on the table, you've taken it apart, right? And then you've put it back together, and you lay it down on the table. The fact is that there is no pen there that exists independently of your projection of it. And that's what Master Nagarjuna is pointing out here. So our karma forces us to see the parts as a pen. And that's what makes the pen exist. Our karma is what makes the pen exist. The pen doesn't exist in any other way, even as a collection of its parts, assembled correctly. And then there's an example of the reflection of a moon in a teacup. Now, the moon's huge. But you could be outside on a nice summer evening, and there's a full moon up there, and you've got a cup of tea on the table in front of you, and you glance down, and here's a reflection of the moon in the teacup. Now, is the moon really there? Well, no, of course it isn't really there. What you're looking at is just conditions that have come together. You know, there's a smooth surface of the tea, which means that there's nothing, there's no movement around, so the surface isn't disturbed. There's a moon up in the sky. And what it looks like is that there's a moon in the teacup. But we know that there isn't. Now, our entire reality is like this. We are perceiving things in a way that they do not exist. Our entire reality is like that. The things that bother us are only reflections of our karma. The things that make us happy are only reflections of our karma. These things do not have a nature of their own. They don't come from their own side, independent of our karma. So it is the fact that because things are an illusion, that we must do good deeds. Our good deeds are going to provide us with pleasant illusions, pleasant experiences. And the bad things that we do are going to provide us with bad illusions, you know, bad experiences. And this is what it means in a line of the text that says, if only in a mirror. Now, there's a kind of a dangerous line that comes here. There is nothing you should practice. That does not mean that you shouldn't practice. You might read it to mean that, but that's not what it means. It means that there's nothing you should practice that comes from its own side. We must always keep this in mind. Everything is a creation of our karma. Even our practice is a creation of our karma. The things that we practice is a creation of our karma. Then it says, strip everything of your projections. Meaning that we must try to understand that the things around us and everything that we like and everything we don't like and even ourselves is just a result of our karmic projections. And then it says, leave your mind as it came from the beginning, that never was. And then there's a phrase, primordial state. Primordial state could mean our Buddha nature, which isn't a little Buddha in us, as we talked about before, but it's the fact that the emptiness of our mind and the emptiness of a Buddha's mind are not different in any respect at all. Because our mind has no nature of its own, it's empty of having any nature of its own. Because of that, we can change it and become enlightened. So we must always consider the emptiness of our mind. The emptiness of our mind is pure, meaning that it's untarnished by anything else. So the fact that our mind is a projection and only a projection is what gives us hope that we can become a Buddha. When we really understand that, then we understand that, yeah, damn it, I can become a Buddha. It gives us hope. And how do we become a Buddha? By doing good things, cherishing others, studying emptiness, all of those things, doing the six perfections. So karma and emptiness are forever, eternally married together. They cannot exist separately. If things aren't empty, karma cannot work. If there's no such thing as karma, then there can't be things. It's sort of like that. There can't be emptiness either. So because everything's an illusion, we must keep our vows. We must do that. If we want to become Buddhas, if we want to stop suffering even, we must keep our vows. We have to do that. So every time that you have a really bad emotion, what you do is attack your own self-cherishing and your ignorance, you know, grasping at the thing as being self-existent. Whenever something really bad happens to you, just sit down and say, nope, damn it. It doesn't exist from its own side. It's just my karma, you know. And it's my karma because I've watched out for myself and haven't watched out for others. And then do something, you know, right then and there, at least visualize yourself helping somebody else. That's what we do. And you do that, you know, with the ferocity of this wrathful monster with the Amantika. That's what we do it as. You know, think of all these, you know, big blockbuster movies that have these huge, horrible creatures in them. That's what you've got to become. You know, you're not going to attack the world. You're going to attack your mental afflictions. You know, all the bad things you've done. Self-cherishing and ignorance. So, that's it. We can take some questions.